This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. One of the ways FDR tried to restart the economy in the Great Depression was to create federal loan programs to help Americans with home ownership. First program was aimed at families in danger of losing their property to foreclosure. Then the government offered loans to new buyers that put some home ownership within the reach of the working class. It was a way to finance the American dream. But the programs were off limits to African Americans. The government drew boundaries between neighborhoods that were eligible and ineligible for the new loans. The so-called risky areas were usually low-income African-American communities, and the practice became known as redlining. Today, a project that has its roots at UNC Chapel Hill draws those original boundaries over today's maps to show their lasting effects. Richard Marciano is the founder of the project. It's called Mapping Inequality. He's now a professor in the College of Information Studies at the University of Maryland and joins us now. Richard Marciano, thanks for being here.
My pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Nathan Connolly. He's a history professor at Johns Hopkins University and one of the project's leads. Hello, Nathan.
Good morning.
Richard, tell us about this project. Why did you start it? What was going on?
I actually started this when I was in, just before coming to North Carolina. I was still in California. I'd moved to San Diego. And just before I became aware of this whole redlining federal process, what the lead-in to this project had to do with what folks call restrictive deeds. These are racial deeds. And I moved into this beautiful, pristine neighborhood of San Diego and in 1995 with beautiful craftsman houses, mostly white, actually almost 100% white, and kept hearing references to deeds, racial deeds. And it took me a little while to come across that first reference, and that was my shoe-in or my first foray into sort of this racialized neighborhood space.
Restrictive covenants. These are things on the deed that say you as the owner, may not sell this to African Americans.
So this is exactly right. These are racial restrictions burned into sort of the birth certificate of the property, the initial deed, typically stating that no person other than belonging to the Caucasian race can live there, spend the night there, other than in the capacity of servant, et cetera. So those are the typical references you'll see.
And we've come to associate this with the South. I was raised in Kenmore, New York, near Buffalo. My house had a restrictive covenant on it, and that explains why there was no one in Kenmore, New York ever who was African-American while I lived there. This is Buffalo, New York. So it was not a Southern thing. Nathan Connolly, tell us about this. How did this become enshrined, essentially, in government policy?
So there were a series of ideas about economics and how you generated economic growth by ensuring racial peace, by protecting the kind of economic integrity of communities. And you had a number of really important kind of thinkers working in the early 20th century in the Progressive Era who were establishing kind of guidelines that eventually became part of federal policy. One economist, for instance, was a man named Richard T. Ely, who was considered the father of land economics. He actually got his training at Johns Hopkins, my current employer, but eventually went on to his most significant contributions at the University of Wisconsin. And Ely was a eugenicist, right? He had very clear ideas about protecting the Anglo-Saxon race. And he looked at moments like the Red Summer in 1919 in Chicago or the moments of racial conflict and used as evidence to show that the races could not, in fact, live in the same communities in peace, that you had to find ways of ensuring that you could keep communities of color and white communities separate, that would generate certain guarantees about economic growth, property values increasing, and that eventually went on to trickle into other areas of economics. Homer Hoyt is another economist, this one at the University of Chicago, who eventually became the principal economist at the Federal Housing Administration. So the person writing the federal policy had very clear ideas about how property values kind of rose and fell based on racial groups kind of commingling. And there's an interesting notion that even if black buyers, when they move into a neighborhood, might cause property values to go up, that the property values would then decline dramatically as whites began panic selling. So part of the point of figuring out how to standardize the color line and discriminatory real estate practices was about keeping white buyers safe and secure in their investment by ensuring them that no black buyers would ever come into those communities.
Right, so you've got a social theory. It becomes tied to financial theory, but it becomes federal policy with the institution of the Homeowners Loan Corporation in 1933. Tell us about that.
So the HOLC's primary role was to save distressed homeowners. And so the maps that became what they're most well known for now, the colored maps with A, B, and C, and D grades and corresponding colors of green, blue, yellow, and red, were supposed to give lenders an idea of which neighborhoods they could safely lend to. Now, the HOLC itself provided a kind of restructuring for buyers who were in foreclosure. And so those grades helped to designate which homeowners would be allowed to fail, which ones would suffer foreclosure. And the HOLC tended to save those home buyers or homeowners in those green and blue neighborhoods and helped to transfer property from poor homeowners in those yellow and red areas. And so what you see from the very beginning of the HOLC's program is a kind of federal exacerbation of property transfer, right? Property that was many cases owned by black buyers, it then moves to white rental speculators because the black buyers couldn't afford to stay in those homes during the Depression. So the HOLC, from the very outset, before the FHA was even established in 1934, begins to kind of take out the meager economic floor that existed under communities of color.
All right. So you've got this now you've got this federal program that is, creating maps and actually transferring the wealth from families to another, from African-Americans to whites. Then we get to the FHA, Nathan, and tell us about this, which then is going to try to help new homeowners and open home ownership to essentially people who had never enjoyed home ownership before. How does that play into this?
So the FHA is an agency that has had a lot of attention given to it over the last 10 or 15 years by historians because it's just done so many different things within the American real estate economy. The first was it simply helped to just standardize building practices. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine that there wasn't any federal oversight of building practices prior to this period in any substantial degree. And so the FHA's job was to make sure that you didn't have homes that were being built to kind of dangerous specifications, right? In order to get mortgage insurance, you had to meet certain kinds of building codes. So that helped automatically ensure that certain buyers who were going to get access to FHA loans would also have homes that would just be safer, which I think is really important. The other thing that's important to bear in mind is that the FHA was providing lenders with a kind of guarantee, mortgage insurance, so that those lenders could then in turn safely give out money and get money flowing in the economy again. The point about the FHA's working with single-family homes, on the one hand, is there were some very clear ideas that single-family homes were the best way to grow the American economy during the Depression. Single-family home buyers would create new opportunities for builders, but also buy appliances to create, new jobs and the like. But the FHA was also having its eye on the rental market, and eventually it got into writing mortgage insurance, not just for single family homes, but also for rental properties. And so you see the federal government not just helping whites buy homes in large amounts, but also targeting black neighborhoods for rental properties. So those neighborhoods that couldn't get access to mortgages became really great kind of confined marketplaces for landlords looking to make money through rent. And so you have the FHA helping on the one hand to keep building standards better, but it's also creating a kind of dual housing market for whites and blacks.
We're mapping inequality on the state of things. My guest, Richard Marciano of the University of Maryland, Nathan Connolly of Johns Hopkins. So, Richard Marciano, you've been digitizing these maps that were created that have these codes on them. And again, kind of go through the rankings and what we would have seen on those original maps and tell us what you did.
So my initial contribution to this project was not to take one, but to take the entirety of the maps and cities in the state of California. So that went from San Francisco, Oakland, Sacramento, all the way down to San Diego. So the idea was to have a complete set, sort of a regional corpus where you could now visually study all these factors that we've just described and actually interact and query them. So it's what folks these days are calling a type of digital humanities or digital history, public history project. What I went after in these maps to emphasize what Nathan just said, I think one of the really incredible inventions of HOLC and FHA was that they added evaluation not just for the individual for attaining credit, but for an entire neighborhood. And this is really important in terms of what you see on the maps and the actual digital design we went after. So I ended up, after some careful thought, trying to capture that important fact. So the map is organized around these boundaries, these colored neighborhood boundaries, as sort of the unit of analysis. You can click on individual boundaries. You can filter them. You can say, show me all the yellows, show me all the reds. And you can query the content that's behind these physical boundaries. And what you get back are sort of filtered, dynamic subsets of the maps. So if you're querying on things like place, class, race, buildings, infrastructure, or combinations of these factors, what you'll get is a brand new dynamic map that comes back, zooms in and focuses on those particular areas where, for example, racial covenants are referenced, where restricted deeds might show up, where you might have references to laborers, executives, Negroes, whites, that's terminology in these maps, et cetera.
Well, I tell you what, when we come back, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to find out what has happened over time to those neighborhoods that were restricted. When my conversation continues with Richard Marciano, a professor in the College of Information and Sciences at the University of Maryland, Nathan Conley is a history professor at Johns Hopkins. We are mapping inequality on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about redlining in the New Deal era and how we're feeling it today. My guest, Richard Marciano, a founder of a project called Mapping Inequality. Nathan Conley is a history professor at Johns Hopkins University. And Nathan Conley, just to kind of recap, I mean, this program, we talked about these restrictive covenants, they're in there because the FHA says we will not back loans unless you put this covenant on the deed and say it may not be resold to black people. In other words, it is federal policy now not to make these loans available to African Americans owing to a social theory that then makes its way into an economic theory that says, you know, property values are going to go down. These are going to be bad loans. We can't afford it. But the effect is African Americans are cut off from this program. Isn't that right?
That's right. The underwriting manual for the Federal Housing Administration, which was written in 1937, has very clear language about the best way to underwrite these loans and to ensure that they'll be, again, safe investments. It's actually kind of interesting to think about this moment in American history, the 1930s and 1940s, and even the 1950s, and these developments of professional networks, ideas that are being circulated through industry magazines, are being shared at conferences, are being disseminated by federal officials, and their ideas about how best to make sure that you have a kind of open marketplace for certain kinds of people to buy and other kinds to rent. And so what's interesting is that African Americans in some cases were able to use the federal bureaucracy to their benefit. So, for instance, there are some stories coming out of Chicago that the FHA officials there were helpful in creating new areas for black expansion. So they would try to lean on areas that were blocked by restrictive covenants and make a few giveaway piecemeal. So once the population, say, on the south side of Chicago balloons to kind of unsustainable levels, FHA officials would then go try to get certain kinds of restricted covenants broken to then enable segregated real estate expansion, but only on a very small scale. So the federal officials knew very well and very intricately how to use these racial restrictions to keep areas blocked or to break them in order to open areas up for safe expansion.
So we're creating our own version of South Africa's homelands in a way. Right?
I guess that's right.
So you got that going, but also, and as you pointed out, then the other areas, the poor areas that are not going to be available for home ownership, then become available for rental, meaning white owners will own these and perhaps rent them back to African-American renters.
Absolutely.
All right. So, and yeah, I mean, go ahead.
No. So this is one of the least known stories about American prosperity is the extent to which the country relied on these very confined rental markets. Just to give you kind of one example, in South Florida in 1950, you could have a small shotgun shack that had maybe four rooms that in some cases would have to be shared by two families that was giving someone the equivalent of $18 a week in rent. So black families would have to pay $18 a week to live there, and this would oftentimes have no indoor plumbing, no electrical service, and the like. On the other side of the color line, in hotels on the beach, you could get a room, sometimes with electrical service and even a TV, depending upon the year, for $17.50 or 50 cents cheaper than it costs to rent on the black side of town, right? And so you have these huge swaths of American cities that are generating tremendous amounts of wealth because African Americans and other people of color, sometimes Asians or Latinos, would have very little choice about where they could live, and therefore they were forced to pay more and get less.
I suppose we should make the distinction here between wealth and income. Wealth is something where you have an equity stake in any kind of property, and it grows, hopefully, and as it grows, your wealth develops, and you can probably have something to pass on to your kids, unlike income, which largely we spend unless we have enough left over to save. So this has deep impacts going forward, generation to generation.
That's absolutely right. I mean, not only do you have people who are renting properties who can't accumulate equity in their real estates, but even those folks who have enough money to buy homes but can't because they can't get the bank financing are forced to take out more dangerous forms of credit. And one of the most dangerous is a form called contract selling, which basically meant you were on a rent-to-own kind of agreement with the homeowner, and you would pay that person on a regular monthly basis. Sometimes there'd be a balloon payment involved. But if for whatever reason, financial hardship, a spouse loses a job, if you missed a single payment, there was no foreclosure proceeding, there was no sense of keeping you in your home, you lost everything immediately, and that property could then be given to another person under a similar rent-to-own agreement. And according to work by Beryl Satter and other historians, some 85% of all the homes occupied by African Americans were bought on these contract terms. Again, these aren't rentals. These are just the folks who tried to have real estate by way of buying, even when they had the money. And so it's really kind of striking when you think about how you have families who, for one wrong turn or through some kind of dishonest mean, they can't seem to accumulate wealth over generations and pass that down.
And of course, you talked about a contract, which is a legal document. But if you're a member of a race that doesn't enjoy the same legal protections, then your day in court is probably going to turn out badly. Richard, I want to talk with you now about what we see these days, because you started out in California. You've done these maps here in North Carolina as well. So if we take a look at what happened in the 30s and we overlay what's going on today, give us some comparisons. Let's start with Durham. What might we see in those redlined districts today, and how do they compare to the areas, the green areas, which were the highest wealth areas?
So when I moved to North Carolina 5 years ago, I actually brought online the five cities that are part of this collection, which include Durham, Asheville, Winston-Salem, Greensboro, Charlotte. And so there's some really interesting differences between California, and these maps are really stunning. On the surface, it's almost this beautiful, colorful mosaic, and when you zoom in, the level of detail is kind of hits you in the stomach. As a matter of fact, the area where the studio is based was one of these redlined areas in 1937. I think we may have
It's interesting,
a description there.
Yeah, this is an appraisal document, right? So this is an official document, and it appraises the land in this area to determine whether it's eligible for the loan. And in the at the bottom, point 14, clarifying remarks. So here are the clarifying remarks about this area where we're sitting right now at American Tobacco. White population largely on McMahon Street for about two blocks south of the railroad, and some on South Street and on McMahon Street for several fairly nice homes. This was formerly a good white residential street, but Negroes are gradually taking up the area, unquote.
And as a matter of fact, if you look at sorry for the details, but Section 5D, you explicitly have sort of a concentration, a reference to the percentage of Negroes living in that area, hence determining the color. And in the case of what's now the radio studio area, it's 90%. If you contrast that to other areas in Durham at the time, you take, for example, the Forest Hills area, which I just pulled up, which is rated as a pristine A5 area, and you look at those same categories, you essentially have percent Negro 0%. In the clarifying remarks, you will see just general remarks on the healthy lifestyle of the neighborhood, and the fact that the neighborhood is substantially composed of good incomes, et cetera. So what's very different for southern cities, when you contrast that to California cities, is that it's much terser. A lot of the information is sort of understood. You have to really read between the lines. In the case of California, where you had a massive influx of immigrants, the descriptions are much more vitriolic and in your face, and go into excruciating details about each ethnic group, their characteristics, their level of infiltration, and the kind of threat they represent.
And this is, again, federal paperwork we're filling out. So in order to qualify for these loans. So this was a largely industrial area. Let's take a look at the and this talks about redevelopment, which I want to talk about in a minute. But let's look at the residential areas of Durham, those areas that were redlined then, what those residential areas look like today. Contrast that with Forest Hills, which is, as you say, an area that was highly qualified at the time and doing quite well today.
Well, I think a really, if you roll forward in time, these maps were, I think, as we hinted at earlier, were also predictive. So what you see on these maps, and you have to go into them to sort of discover that, is it's not just the four color codes. There are colored areas with hash marks, and it was a special designation. They euphemistically call it sparsely settled. So these were areas with low populations, so growth areas, and they were given a color assignment. And if you go into the details in the text and descriptions, this was really predictive. This was, we want these neighborhoods to have this future racial concentration 70 years down the road. So what these maps and the digital version are really interesting for is actually viewing them as sort of ground zero base maps and looking at their predictive power and the impact they had down the road, which is right now in our future. And so there are a lot of interesting analyses you can do by looking at what succeeded and what didn't, the level of changes, et cetera, to roll it all the way back to the present. One of my colleagues in California, Jesus Hernandez, did a wonderful study putting together essentially subprime activity in 2009. So he used federal databases on those loans that flopped completely. And he layered those. He looked at the geographies of restrictive covenants, redlining, and then subprime loans. And what he came up with was absolutely stunning. Essentially, he's challenging this notion of market neutrality. He looked at Sacramento in particular. And his findings show a trajectory, sort of a compounded effect in the future, in our present, and a really strong correlation of how all these policies, not just one, but sort of this layering of policies over time, from the racialized housing credit stuff we talked about with redlining to the 60s, 70s, and 80s redevelopment and relocation policies, to the deregulation and subprime mortgage market. So his findings indicate an absolutely strong signal, sort of a continuation. And there have been some really interesting conversations over the last few years. I was part of one in 2008 at the University of California, Santa Barbara, with lawyers at the table, actually looking at this notion, which is being rediscussed right now, debated, on remediation and on reparations. Mm. And on changing case law, in some sense, to demonstrate that the preponderance and overlapping of all these factors was so egregious and so harmful that special measures need to be taken up, and that this might be and that the footprint of this redlining and its continuation in the present might be a good case study.
Well, I think what your maps do, and by the way, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org, and you can work these interactive maps and see what we're talking about for yourselves. We've got links to the maps at stateofthings.org. But what your maps show, and Nathan, your research and others show, is that this is not just the invisible hand saying, well, you know, these are not good loans because of a social thing, and we bankers didn't have anything to do with that. We're sorry, but the invisible hand dictates this. No, no. It's a social policy. It was a directed policy and very deliberate attempts to do these things.
And if I may add just one more thing on the theme of North Carolina. So if you look at a city like Asheville, it's the only city for which I actually overlaid the 1930s redlining maps with the 1970s and 80s so-called urban renewal maps. What you see there, I worked with Priscilla Robinson and I, who's chair of the South Side Neighborhood Community Group. This was a predominantly African-American neighborhood, 97% African-American, some 1,300 households. In the 1970s, about 1,000 houses were bulldozed, essentially making way for progress, highways, as it happened in Durham, in the case of Haiti, and lots of black neighborhoods. But the signal there, that's really what I want to convey, and you see the embedding of these policies, is that the outcome of the 1930s, which identified and determined that certain neighborhoods were red and hence not worthy of all this support, federal support and services, that labeling was reused. It was picked up in the 60s and 70s. Those neighborhoods were considered blighted. Hence, when the next batch of federal funding came, that was the starting point for the next phase, which was incredibly destructive and disruptive. That's sort of the last blow to a lot of these neighborhoods when folks were evicted and relocated.
And it's very clear in your maps of Asheville, and you can also see it here in Durham, where the line for 147 goes right through the heart of those redline neighborhoods. Nathan, we talked about these maps getting drawn in the 30s. How long did they persist?
Well, the maps themselves, the program that the HOLC put forth only lasted from the mid-30s to 1951, and the HOLC officially closed down as an agency. But I wanted to return to something that Richard mentioned, just in terms of thinking about the generational impact of this and these long-term practices. I mean, one of the most amazing things when you read these area descriptions and you figure out who the real estate appraisers were, I mean, their names are listed on these forms. And you can just go to, you know, real estate sections in local papers in these cities and see that, in fact, in most cases, these appraisers are also developers and real estate entrepreneurs or financiers in the cities. And so it's not simply that they were drawing areas that would then have a kind of predictive kind of power that we can look at today, is that they were actually determining where they wanted their next big investment to be, right? They could have some kind of control over that. And so just thinking about the on-the-ground kind of aspects of this, I think, are really important to bear in mind. The other thing is that everyday homeowners were also becoming aware of these maps and the way that they worked through realtors and other kinds of associations. There are great meeting minutes, for instance, in southern cities where you see homeowners approaching city council people and talking about these neighborhoods as being, you know, blighted or turning down their investments in kind of an adverse way, and these city council people then approving slum clearance or slum clearance initiatives in the early and mid 40s that would essentially erase black communities that were too close to white communities or for the comfort of those white homeowners. And there are some remarkable and dramatic stories of expulsion going on in the post-war periods. In some cases, black families who had children who fought in World War II, entrepreneurs who have their own businesses, who are suffering a kind of dramatic displacement because of neighboring whites who want to protect their property values based on these maps and understandings of those maps. Just the other thing, in terms of these displacement politics, this is before you even get to the dramatic kind of highway programs of the 60s and after, is that you have black homeowners and white slumlords, in many cases, drawing common cause and becoming allies to keep out large-scale urban development programs because they both have something to lose. And so there's a really unknown history about the complexities of interracial coalitions built not around civil rights, but about property rights and keeping government officials from dispossessing people of their real estate.
Right. Richard, tell us about this project going forward. What are your hopes for it? How do you see it expanding?
So I'm really pleased to have joined forces with Nathan at Johns Hopkins. I really want to mention the two other partners in the project, Rob Nelson at the University of Richmond, who's done a lot of digital work with redlining of Richmond and cities in Virginia, as well as Dale Windling at Virginia Tech. So we've formed a coalition, and we have a brand new project, which is one where we're going national. So we want to essentially make every single map available online, and we've started the process. We've digitized the entire collection, which is in boxes at the National Archives, hence really not accessible to the public. Mm-hmm. And we're building this essentially big data. It's a popular term these days, but that's really what this was. This was a 1930s big data project, and we're going to be mapping tens of thousands of neighborhoods, and we want to open this up for public access, for interaction, and there's there are all these interesting stories that have not been told yet. And so my contribution is a little bit more on the digital side and the infrastructure and coming up with clever ways to enable this information to be found and correlated and visualized.
You can find it at our website, stateofthings.org. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Marciano is the founder of Mapping Inequality, a professor in the College of Information Sciences at the University of Maryland. And Nathan Connolly is a history professor at Johns Hopkins University. We have samples of the maps at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, how North Carolina schools are becoming more segregated again. Stay tuned.